Welcome to AmiSites, a podcast that offers you access to thought leaders who can help you expand your entrepreneurial toolbox. Learn from seasoned entrepreneurs who have already walked in your shoes and can help you with your day-to-day business decisions. Join the founder and CEO of Multifunding, Ami Kassar, and his co-host, Lynn Ozer, the president of Multifunding, aka the SBA Queen, as they help you navigate, grow, and stay in control of your business.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the next edition of AmiSites. I'm Ami Kassar, your host, along with my co-host, Lynn Ozer, aka SBA Queen. Super excited to have my friend on today, Chris Burkhard, CEO and founder of Placers, fascinating company in the recruitment space, and also a generally fascinating guy with a lot of different business perspectives and background. And Chris, thank you for being on. Looking forward to chatting with you and learning everything you have to tell us.
You know, thank you for having me on the show. I always find that I learn as much as I'm able to give. So I enjoy the process of these exchanges.
Awesome. So why don't we just start and tell us a little bit about what you're up to these days?
Sure. I'd be delighted to do that. Well, coming out of the flattening of this pandemic, I'm at an interesting intersection in the world. I help people figure out their careers, help them realize that they're responsible for their careers and what that looks like. And then I have to help businesses figure out how to have the right number of people in the right seats in the right flavors, meaning temp or contract or freelance or gig. So it's a really interesting time in that part of the things. I run a company, Placers, fourth generation entrepreneur, and I find that there's an awful lot of people that need help to understand how to manage their career or how to get the right labor in their business.
So take us back further. So what brought you to this? You have an entrepreneurial spirit, and most people that are entrepreneurs are probably born with that. But did you go to school or college thinking that you wanted to own a specific kind of business, or did you have a different career path before you got to where you are today?
So I'm a fourth generation Delaware entrepreneur. My grandmother owned a grocery store in downtown Wilmington, Delaware. Pretty unusual thing for a female-owned business all those years ago.
Absolutely. My
grandfather owned Burkhard Hardware, and my father watched it burn to the ground when he was 14. And so my father and I have been in staffing or search or human capital since 1972.
Wow.
I'm going to cough, but I guess I'll just say it, 30 years in the business. So you could say it was a family calling, but for me, it was more about when we had Sunday dinner, my dad would say to me and my two sisters, you know, you have more control over your life if you're your own boss. Don't give that up and don't work for somebody else or something along those lines. So, you know, that's not for everybody, but that was for me. And that was my story.
Oh, that's great. So you really came to it naturally, right? So you've been doing this a long time.
Yeah. And some days it feels like for 5 minutes because I'm still learning.
So Chris, let's dig in a little bit, because when we met for the first time, maybe a decade or longer ago, you were doing some, I think, scaling up coaching.
Yes.
Or something tied to that. And were you doing that and Placers at the same time, or did you jump into Placers later? Did you take over from your dad at some point? Tell us your journey a little bit more.
I'd love to. So you're right. We did meet, and I'm still a closet certified scaling up coach, Ami. I still, you know, pay dues and have access to the intellectual property. And I keep a handful of customers that I've had for a very long time. You know, it's good to be kept around when you help people grow or hit their targets or help them with their business. At the time, you know, so I was one of those guys that grabbed, you know, if you don't mind, Mastering the Rockefeller Habits was like a Bible for me when I first started the business. And my whole journey has been, I'm going to read it, I'm going to apply it, I'm going to master it. And then I would give my time away, Ami. I would give time away to the not-for-profit where I was board chair. I helped my CPA firm implement it. And then some people would ask me to do their one-page plan, or they'd help me to ask them to figure out their BHAG, or they'd say, help me get my five core values and run that exercise. So for years and years and years, I gave it away. And then one day somebody said, you know it as well as the coaches. Why don't you do some of this? And really, I was just applying it at Placers. You know, to tell that story, I started this business the morning of 9/11. My first employee started at 8:30. Obviously, it's a day that has much more importance to the world. But it was the day I gambled on me. It was the day I went for it all. And my first employee started. And then all of a sudden, it became pretty un-American to sell anything. So that was a really big shocker. And, you know, the brands aside, I helped my dad sell the original Placers in the mid to late 90s. And, you know, he was a brilliant man because he owned the company. He owned the name, kept the name. They bought the assets. And long story short, I originally was in the consulting space, the human resources space. I was originally doing recruitment outsourcing only. And I ran into that 08, 09, 10 time period. And I had a lot of clients that weren't outsourcing recruiting, but they were starting to use temps again, starting to use contractors, starting to want different kinds of solutions. So I kind of crawled on my hands and knees to my dad and said, how do you feel about me using Placers again? Well, it hasn't been used in 15 years, Chris. And I'll be, I'm sure this is a G-rated audience, but he said, you can have it, but don't F this up. And you know what he more likely said, don't you F up my legacy. And I took all those things of the consulting business and kind of blended it into Placers, and it grew like crazy. And Ami, one of our recent dialogues, you know, I think this is tongue in cheek. I'm 8 times in a row Inc. 5000. Our exchange was that it isn't all roses and candy and glory to achieve that, right? You know, there's a dark side and a downside to an award like that. But I started with the habits to run my own business. I'm one of that weirdos that self-implemented, backed into it, ran a mastermind for a lot of years, and then Placers really, really started to go. So that group was taken over by somebody else. And, you know, last 5 years or so, I've really been focusing on Placers, and the pandemic didn't help much, right? There's certainly a few more things to do and think about than the normal distractions and risks of running a business.
Of course. What exactly did the pandemic do to your business?
So my bills are paid with contract workers. You know, I manage them for clients, or they're my own contract workers. It's a mix of both. So we were very blessed to have a handful of customers that were necessary in producing something that helped get us through those times. So we actually grew initially. We grew initially, but about 30% of our people were office workers, you know, and all of those went home. But those that were making masks and other things were put to work. And, you know, there's a lot of, you know, it was not an easy time, I can say that. And certainly very difficult to run the business from home, but that's not a unique story. We all kind of went through that. There's been a lot of good that's come out of it. And there's a lot I think we're still unpacking, Lynn.
Yeah, I think a lot of people love what happened in staying home and working from home, and others that don't want it that way. So that's interesting. But in a placement business, I mean, jobs were not as plentiful, obviously, during that time. So do you focus on any specific industry?
So I always talk about that we're really very client-centric, and I focus on wallet share. So I help an organization really across all skill sets within an organization. But I often bring in partners and vendors to do the stuff that we don't do.
So let's dig in. So are you exclusively doing recruiting, or are you doing broader HR strategy or team development? Tell us a little bit about what an engagement looks like for you, sure. What type of businesses, where they're located, et cetera, et cetera.
So I've always been geographic centered first, Lynn. And so, you know, our theme for many years, Ami, was to own Delaware. You know, our theme was, and we repeated it for a few years until we felt we got there. There's segments in our business. We have a professional business, you know, that it looked at corporate America and thought about staffing a paralegal or a human resources manager or, you know, a bookkeeper, a marketing person. Our professional business does that work, and that's been true for many, many years. We have a commercial practice where our growth is representative of the gaps in national and local market. We're focused in manufacturing, supply chain, and most recently in skilled labor. There is a shortage of 3 million workers nationally in skilled labor, and I think it's over 50,000 just in the state of Delaware. And so I'm talking carpenters, plumbers, welders, you know, jig workers, and a whole host of other titles around that. And a lot of times we're asked to, so what do I do best, Tommy? It's kind of interesting. Sometimes I get, people don't like this answer. What we're really good at is creating a marketing plan to find talent and executing it. And that's our secret sauce, how to talent map, how to use sources, how to leverage technology. And by the way, it's always a new technology. It's not particularly sexy because there's a new one tomorrow. What we have to be able to do is use it to get the job done because it'll be replaced with something. If my pop were here and he's 80, he'd say that the high tech was the first time we had a database and it wasn't a filing cabinet, right? Where you didn't have to use a fax machine. But our job over and over again is to show people how to get things done that if they had the time or the gumption, they could probably do themselves. But it's, you know, doing something over and over and over again with a lot of work to get staffing done for people. So most of our work is contractors. Where I see our world going, I mean, think of all the professional managers that you know and how it's different than it was 20 years ago. Say they had 100 person in their department. Well, back then it was all their people, right? Today, the world's demanding somebody in that business is probably demanding that 20 or 30 of them be freelance, contract, a third party that they work with. Mm-hmm. And they have all the same compliance issues. They've got all the same HR challenges. How do they manage the cost of that, the budgeting? So my value add, Ami, is to be able to provide a managed service so that they can use contingent labor in their business and things like dashboards or things like, we have one client where we have to promise global onboarding exactly the same, no matter where that person gets their laptop and goes through training and, you know, and the bill shows up the same way. You know, that's what their problem is. That's what they view as value. But the world's using more temps, more contractors, and it's more than just what placers can do. Somebody needs help organizing all that. Now, you need a bookkeeper. We still got to do that too, right?
Are you seeing any or partnering up or doing it yourself, adding any overseas talent, or is it all based on the U.S.?
It's a very interesting question. We have two partners that are providing overseas talent that I think they're called employer of record firms. And we're being asked that more and more. I'll be curious to see if we're giving an entrepreneurial opportunity to solve that, or if we have to have a proof of concept that's exactly perfect to do it. But with our existing customers, where they're adding somebody in Canada or somebody in Japan or Thailand, we're finding vendors that have the ability to do that. And it does roll up to our program.
Completely fascinating.
Go ahead. Do you work with like college grads who are just looking for a job, or that's way not your area?
You know, honestly, we need all talent, honestly. So it'll be intern season soon. So there's certainly, and organizations, many are outsourcing the payroll of that. So they'll go through placers in some cases. So we'll meet a bunch. But yeah, it's pretty tough, Lynn, right now to be a college grad, right? It's a difficult time. Maybe not as good a market as it's been, probably twice as long as it was to get a job for most professionals. So it's not easy pickings. Just put your stuff out on the internet and get a couple of offers by Friday today. Although it's still a very strong market.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So Chris, tell us a little bit about your organization. Like, how many of you are there?
Sure. Well, we're a group of 32 internal employees, and then the contractors flex up and down. I think, you know, we all want the vulnerability. I've chased the headcount internally, you know, the glamour metrics. And now I've found a way. For a long time, I think my business was a bunch of heroes that lived the values, that did extraordinary things in selling and serving. And now we're on a quest to have checklists, to map things to technology, to have better processes, to do things with, to digitize the firm. And, you know, it's a hell of a journey, excuse my French. but we are clearly on that. And we just keep automating things, Ami, and we keep saying use talents for other things. But, you know, I guess I'm done that phase where I'm just trying to add headcount just because it sounds good or feels good.
And are they all located in the central office, or are they all over the country?
You know, for the long time, we were in one place, but we're probably in 7 or 8 states. We're virtual, hybrid, and we certainly have some folks that go to one office every day, Ami.
That's interesting. Could we go back to when you and your dad sold your company? I think that's sure. something that our listeners are also interested in. If we could hear what were some of the problems or the challenges that you faced when selling your business and how you overcame them.
Well, I think my answer will probably surprise you, and it may not be what you're exactly looking for. I was 27 or 28, and I was a very talented young man that hadn't failed yet. So that business was sold before I was ready to run it by about a year, maybe 2 years. So Lynn, what ended up happening is the company that bought us made me president when my father retired. And my dad started that business in the early 70s. He was original bootstrap. He did not give out equity. He did not, you know, he built it from cash flow. What an unbelievable story. That I've heard Ami talk about that choice so many times, but, you know, he did it the hard way and it limited growth. However, he made it work. And so when he sold the business, it was the kind of thing where all I could do was I going to do pay him $100 a week? You know, to buy this business from him. So I just missed the opportunity. But what happened is I stayed and had a great opportunity to be a mid-market leader in a global company. I traveled the world. I had training in Europe. I got some perspective. And then I learned pretty quickly that I was more of an entrepreneur than I was a middle manager. So I started that business in 01. And as you heard, I launched it that year. Yeah. So what did I see? I watched it from a distance and tried to take copious notes, but was, you know, obviously it was not my business that was being sold. You know, it was watching the family business. However, my son's in the business today. And one of the things we've passed down is I know you either earn or you learn. And I learned everything I know to start my company from that experience with, you know, I'm hoping to pass down to my son, Josh, as he's in the business too. So, you know, that's okay, right? It's just, it wasn't quite right. But by the time things got rolling, you know, it was just fine.
Awesome. Chris, what type, size clients are you typically servicing?
Yeah, we're not the Fortune 100. But we're going to be serving your 5,000 to 15,000 employee set. And then it's really, you drive down I-95 or Route 1 in Delaware, represent the community. So it's small, medium, and large. However, we are in a town of healthcare, financial services, high-tech manufacturing, and I could go on and on. But so we represent our community in that regard, with skilled labor being our fastest growing part of it. So commercial construction primarily.
Let's talk about maybe some COVID dominoes, I like to call them. Are there unique challenges you think your clients are facing today as a result of maybe some of the work from home dynamics that we all learned in COVID?
I feel very qualified to talk about this. In fact, I was recently asked to address this on the radio coming up. So what I see is the issue that isn't being addressed is that leaders want people in the office and they don't want to come into the office. Yet, of course, they're being asked to come back. Now you see it in the sound bites every day. But I see early career folks who maybe didn't have the mentoring or the backgrounds, the connective tissue, if you will, to the company that are floundering a bit, not just not getting promoted, but feeling disengaged because, well, they are disengaged, right? They're doing their job and their interaction is with a much smaller group. And what I heard it said this, Ami, and you probably would agree, we're spending much more time with a handful of people versus a larger percentage of time with a larger group of people. So we feel very good because we spend 100% of our time with five people, but we're not getting that connection to that broader tree within the business. Now, what I see is businesses, small, medium, and large, are putting their foot down and they're at least reinforcing hybrid. But it does seem like everybody's trying to make hybrid work and make it stick.
Yeah. It's super interesting. I think for the younger, there's so many levels of it. Feel free to chime in. But I think for the younger generation, the virtual work became an introvert's dream come true and an extrovert's nightmare. But irrespective of that, you're doing the kids or this generation a complete disservice by not bringing them into the office. There's just certain skills that you're not learning by being in the office. I think when we had to do it to stay alive, that's a different story. But we don't need to do it anymore. And it's very, very confusing and frustrating. I don't know what you guys think.
As the parent of younger employees who worked from home for a while, my son went back to work much quicker than my daughter. My daughter worked at home for like 3 years and now has to go back and is finding it extremely difficult and challenging to go to work 3 days a week, which of course I have absolutely no sympathy for her. And I believe that she should be going. And I'm on Ami's team here. I mean, they miss so much by not being in an office environment. Their ability to just naturally network for work purposes, for advancement purposes, and for social purposes. It's just not there when you sit in a Zoom camera. It's just not there. And even if you tried to make these Zoom happy hours, you can't have one-on-one conversations. You can't introduce somebody to somebody else. It just isn't the way that it is. And I just feel that I don't care what business you're in, it's still people doing business with people, and relationships still matter. And I think they always will. And you don't get that or learn how to forge business relationships if you're not in an office.
So as a harebrained entrepreneur, you know, you go through phases, right? You know, I certainly started taking out the trash and paying the bills and making the sales calls. And over time, you let a lot of stuff go. And if I'm a scaling up coach, I'm supposed to take it pretty far, right? You're supposed to evolve that thinking. But I found when I was in our primary office, I might have thought for my leaders, my whole team there. I was always available. So in one way, there has been an advantage in that by me, you know, one thing that came out of this on me is I built this little building. So I have a 12x20 place to work. And for me at mid-50s, being an entrepreneur for 30 years, some health challenges, conserving energy and being able to give the office 2 or 3 days a week, but do some of this. I see the benefit of the hybrid schedule. Like, so, you know, although I'm completely driving the dialogue we're having, for me, I know how to network. This really does work for me. Just recently, I have been missing the heck out of being in the office 5 days a week. Now, I do live at the beaches in Delaware. My one office is 20 miles away. One's 90 miles away. So I got a little bit of a challenge to do that. But you guys are correct. I watch staff. My whole management team will be in on a day. And I can remember in business, if that leader was going to be in the office, I probably found a way to get to that office. Like, I wanted to be there in that meeting or to be in, it doesn't even cross the mind of the people today. It's all just about the day and what they have to get done. And that's what they think their job is versus the connection to what you're talking about, Lynn.
Yeah.
It's interesting. My son, he graduated a year and change ago and it's almost 2 years ago. I can't believe it. And he got recruited out of school to a big consulting company whose name starts with an A. I'll let you guess who it is.
You might know who that is. Yes. Yeah.
And ironically, when this was all happening, their CEO was coming to give a talk about corporate culture. And people were like, lining up to go, and I sort of shook my head. But anyway, instead of taking the kids into their training facility, they figured out they could save millions of dollars a year during COVID, so they were still training them virtually. So 3 weeks of virtual training, and then they say to the kids, okay, well, we don't have jobs for you yet, like gigs, so here's where you go post for gigs, and here's the virtual line library and have a training library, and your supervisor somewhere in the Philippines, and have a good life. Well, my son lasted 52 days, and he went to work for a small community bank where there's, you know, a small team, and I'll never forget, a few months into the gig, they had a small riff, and he watched one of his co-workers get called into an office and have to pack up her box and leave. And he was shaken, understandably. I said, wait till you have to actually do that instead of watch it. That's even worse. But
it is worse.
I said, Sam, do you realize that 10% of your company was laid off while you were there? 10%. He said, yeah, but I didn't know any of those people. And it's just a reflection of learning. You know, he's four or five of them in an office. They have to learn to get along. Who's going to buy lunch? Who's going to get lunch? How are they going to work? Et cetera, et cetera. And it is so hard, I think, for these kids.
You might have to stay till five. You know. One thing that's interesting is that around the peak, between 30 and 35% of jobs were virtual. And we keep saying that now it's below 10. Clearly below 10. And there's stuff that says it's between 5 and 7% of jobs posted. So that's got to tell you something. That's a good stat.
That's all? That's really surprising.
Well, I don't know the hybrid stat. That's substantial, right? That's still substantial.
Okay.
But
okay.
The remote job is considered the gold. And I'm sure you've seen the sound bites that people are willing to work for 20% less all around the world, not just here, that they'll work for less to have that flexibility, which I still think is key. I think flexibility is the key, and I do preach that. But that does not have to be, you know, there's lots of ways to be flexible. You know, I have a dental appointment tomorrow at 9, and you can be a jerk about it, or you can say, that's cool, come back, just make sure you do your job, right? You know, there's all kinds of ways to address that stuff.
So interesting. I read another article the other day that I don't want to quote a stat, but a high percentage of layoffs, first people on layoffs are the remote. If there's a layoff, the first people to go are the remote workers.
So what you could imply by that is for those making the decisions, it's easier when they don't know them.
Correct. That's also.
Oh my gosh! Like, I see Chris's name on this piece of paper. I've never seen him. Oh well, you know, it's always the case. It goes like there's a theory that cuts always happen in threes, Ami. That the first two are always wishful thinking and there's usually a third. And if you watch it now, you're going to see it, that it's, they don't get it right. And it's usually a third cut.
Yeah. It's super interesting in our office. So we have a small team here that's grown a lot since COVID, but we have a core team that have been together for years. And we learned to work remotely during COVID. We figured it out. We had to, we were highly effective. And so in some respects, that group of people earn their rights to stay working remotely. However, as the company is growing now and you're bringing in new people, they need to be trained and absorbed and integrated and all this. And we need everyone in the office. It's very difficult.
What's crazy for me, Ami, is you were like the evening news to me in that you were giving updates to me and then thousands of other entrepreneurs about changes that were impacting my life. So I actually feel like I knew you. I knew you before. Every time you ate a chocolate, I knew what you were thinking, like, or how you were surviving, right? Like, so that whole thing, I mean, and the pandemic's got a lot of different legs to it, right? But I felt like you were in my living room all the time and that I knew you from that, right? And I know the price that took on you because there was a lot of pressure.
But I don't miss it. And I wouldn't have done it any different. We did. And it helped our business, but it wasn't why I did it. We did the right thing, right? We couldn't go to the hospitals to help, but we could go to the businesses to help. And we had sort of a superpower to do that. And we did it. So
what if it's interesting, and please manage me. I don't have a handler. You have a couple. I don't have any today. But so I did an act of kindness where I got on the radio and said, anybody that needs help with their job search, with the resume, with introductions, you know, whatever it would. Usually what I find is, you know, we don't do our own teeth at the dentist. We don't do our own lawyering. We don't usually sell our own house, but almost everybody tries to manage their own career on me. And, you know, that's straight from my book, by the way. But that reality is, you know, we go to our successful aunt or uncle, right? We go to a successful person for like, what do I do, you know, when we're looking for work? So I just try and democratize it and give it away. And it works sometimes because people have to trust and believe in all those things. But honestly, back to that intersection, that's kind of how I view it, is all that stuff we just have to give people to help them manage their own career, because they're not going to enter in the mailroom, stay for 30 years, get the gold watch. That's our grandparents that were lucky enough maybe to have that. We're going to have 7 to 11 different jobs. We're going to change careers, right? We're going to have to take skills and apply them in new ways. We're going to take breaks. We're going to be in our 50s and be caregivers. We're going to take a gap year now. We're going to work 60 years, not 40 years. All that stuff changes the world of work. And by the way, that's why I'm still doing it, because this is what I find so interesting, let alone that there's what, 5 generations working for the first time ever. And I'm not qualified to address that, other than that we're all watching it, trying to make the most of that.
Awesome. Chris, what do you see as the biggest challenges in your business over the next couple of years?
Yeah. And I want to respect that question. I'll tell you what I think it is. And I was trying to make it more interesting. My challenge is probably what some of us are facing, which is government regulation. You know, around 2% of the workforce in North America is temporary staffing. Around between 45 and 50% are a gig worker, freelance, third party outsource, you know, the A word, you know. And I don't feel like our government understands how much of our economy is driven by outsourcing and by third party services. And I think it creates the up and down that we need. You can't just hire 100 people and fire them, right? But you can hire 100 customer service reps for the season, and the work goes down, then I'll find them somewhere else to go. So with the government being unsure about whether or not they really like the idea of a gig worker, I think that's a big deal. And so far, it hasn't been as big a deal. I think the reality is, the second thing, Ami, is that there has been a war for talent since 1995. There is a shortage of talent through 2030 right now. Doesn't it blow your mind that there were 353,000 jobs in January, but the economist said it was going to be 64,000? Like, Ami, if you and I were wrong that much every day, I don't know if people would listen to us, right?
I don't listen to them anyway, but that's...
Well, people ask
me... the weathermen.
They're worse than the weathermen, you're right. But I think what it says to me is, where are the workers? And we better have a very strong immigration policy, because our country has benefited for years from a strong workforce, from an immigration benefit. So that's a challenge. And, you know, and you top it off with the third one, that if I ask 10 Amis about the workforce, they're all telling me that the workforce isn't showing up in the right way with the right skills and the right behaviors. And they'd pay me anything to fix it. And I'm not sure I can. Yeah, you know, they're saying they don't have manners. They're saying they don't know how to conduct themselves in a meeting. They're saying they don't know how to have empathy. You know, I had a customer talking to me the other day. It was in a large collections group, and the customer had had a death in the family. And the collections person said, well, your balance is still due. You know, and the point was, we have to have empathy. We're humans, right? I know you read from the script. You're not wrong, but you know, We need you to think, if you will. We need to show up that way. So, just interesting.
Do you think AI is going to have an impact on all this stuff?
Oh, I absolutely do. I feel like we're in the first or second inning. I tell you what, when I'm trying to find out the background of someone, AI gives it to me in 12 seconds. I'm not sure it's right, but it helps me pull it together, and we always have to fact check it. I think we're starting to see it in all of the core software that's in our ecosystem. And maybe that's going to be the key, Ami, is like, it's literally just embedded in our CRM, salesforce.com. It's just embedded in there. You know, it's like, I don't need to know AI. It's now being applied so that I have this, I've been calling it like an exoskeleton so my salespeople can do more. I think it's going to work for now if it shows up like that.
Got it. Interesting.
Interesting. That is interesting.
Super fascinating. What should we have asked you that we forgot to?
Oh, well, I think you guys are great to ask questions. So the only thing I would want to comment on, if with permission, is I did finally finish a book. This is what I did last year. It's called Opposite the Crowd.
Love it.
During the pandemic, I started to record my dad, you know, with the podcast. And as we were doing it, what he didn't realize till about halfway through the year, he used another cuss word and said, you know what? I figured out you're writing the book. And he was right. So we completed the 13 chapters by audio, and then I worked with editors to turn it into a paper copy. And it just is, it is a love story with a father and son, but basically it's our philosophies of business, philosophies of leadership, sales, managing your own career. But the gist is the title, Opposite the Crowd. My pop just named a horse after it. That's how committed he is to it. But if you think about a crowd, if you're safe, right, with the crowd, you make a mistake, nobody notices. But sometimes going against the grain and standing alone, yeah, it's tough if you fail, right? Because people see it. But really, the only way to be different is to be yourself and be opposite the crowd. And it's just our ideas and philosophies. And, you know, most of them are not original to me, but I'm my father's best student when it comes to those philosophies. So, and we wrote it to the next generation. He wanted people to, it's a legacy book. He wanted people to know how he thought. So that was a whole lot of fun. And, you know, if you don't mind me saying it, you can find it on Amazon or any of your other places. That's great.
I love it.
It's been not going to get rich on me, but it's been fun to put out.
Is there one key nugget about it?
Yes. That most people, yes, one simple thing. People live two lives, the life they have and the life they want. And as they're going through their week, they start to think a little bit about the life they want, but then they run into their job and their kids and soccer practice and groceries and chores. Before you know it, they're back at the job. So we try to provide tools to help people actually establish their own core values and their own way of thinking so that they can have the life that they want. So it's kind of a self-help memoir book, which is a weird genre, but that's, you know, we call it culture of one, you know, getting to know yourself so that you are not distracted by shiny objects, but are able to know yourself so that decision-making and guiding your life is easier.
I love it.
I think it sounds great.
Super
Thank
cool.
You.
I had to get a copy for my kids.
Opposite the crowd.
Well, you make me proud. You guys are great, but that would be the only thing. You know, I don't know if you want to talk about the ink thing, Ami, if we've got enough here, but
sure.
You put something out just inquiring about people that have been on the list a lot. And I think all I wanted to share is that it seemed like every time I got on the list, it was the day I was out of money, or it was the day I was being sued, or it was the day, you know, that payroll blew up. And that those awards are kind of glamour items, and that I do think they're important for staff. I do think clients admire them, but I don't run my business with those things in mind, right? I may have in the beginning, I may have thought too much about them, but something that just drives top line, I just think they're doing a disservice because it's not necessarily the sign of a healthy business.
Correct.
Not at all.
I don't know
all.
If you've heard my idea, Chris, but I want to start a Sleep 5000 list. And what it would be is we pick a minimum revenue threshold, maybe $2 million. And then if you want to be on the list, you have to agree to wear like a sleep monitor or a sleep app for a year. And if you sustain your business at least $2 million, whoever sleeps the most wins.
I actually think it's a great game. And so I'm glad that struck a chord, because I saw your comment and I was like, because so many people are just, I don't know, it's not to knock it, but you have to understand what it is. You have to understand that it's a form of marketing. That's all.
What I don't like about it is, why do we celebrate? In other words, entrepreneurs' goal in life is to get on that list. Okay. And sadly, the high percentage of the defaults we've seen over the years come from people we met at that conference.
Really?
Yeah. And so what do we celebrate? Right. So I see a lot of these, again, it's just my personality, Chris, but I see a lot of these awards, not just that one. There's this new one out, like the Titan 100 in different cities or whatever.
And I just saw that one.
I'm like,
Ami won that.
Of course she did.
And what are we celebrating? And acquiesce, and I agreed to that Titan 100, like just to help them with their launch or whatever in Philadelphia. And then I had to go and do some like video interviews before the award show, which really was their opportunity for their sponsor, the life insurance salesperson, to speak to me for conveniently for 15 minutes before my video shoot. And then they asked me, who's my Titan of industry? And I think they were waiting for me to sort of say Mark Zuckerberg, you know, one of these guys. And I'm like, the owner of the local ExxonMobil in my neighborhood. And they were a little confused. And they said, well, what do you mean? And I go, well, what I mean is that I can drop my car off at his place. He doesn't have to call me and tell me what he's going to do or challenge anything. I get a call when it's done. I come and pick it up and I pay my bill and we're all good. And to me, someone who can run a company like that is a titan of industry.
You know, it reminds me of like the smart CEO, which was the same. It's just a formula kind of thing,
right?
Which is, by the way, the only reason I care now is because I think there's more to a streak of 8 years than there was once.
That's true.
It's all good. And if you're doing it for the healthy way and your business is sustainable and healthy, and there's also a big difference on the Inc. 5000, if you're, you know, where you're sitting on the list or this or that or the other, but just people pushing for that so hard and celebrating it. Yay. I know people are like all over Facebook. So amazing. My dream come true. And a week before they took a $300,000 loan at 80% APR.
Yeah.
So what are we celebrating?
We're not celebrating the truth, which is the real shame thing, right? Like you could do that. You could celebrate bad loans of the year. That might be fun.
No, I don't want to do that. But
no, I understand.
Yeah. And I wish there were awards out there that were like genuine. Like I won't apply for any awards here, anywhere, or get on any award list unless I think it's really valid and legitimate. And I haven't found one.
Well, everything I read, this would be my closing comment, is that when I read about really great leaders that are really great at execution, most of the people that they highlight are pretty boring blokes, Ami.
Exactly.
No, like they're not out there for drama.
Yeah.
They hit their milestones. They use a certain amount of capital for growth. They're, you know, very formulaic. They're not crazy. And you know, I'm more entrepreneurial, but when I look to my expertise for those things, they're pretty boring folks and they just
and
run their
okay.
business with excellence. Right. Which is your point. So,
Chris, where if people want to learn more about your company, where do they come?
My placers, you just Google that. And then Chris-Burkhard, I have a site if someone's interested in, you know, finding my book.
Opposite the crowd.
I love it. Awesome.
Chris, it was so fun to talk to you. Thanks for your time.
And you guys are a dynamic duo. I do listen to you guys. So it was a bit surreal to be one of the ones that hopefully gets listened to. But thank you very much for the invite. Enjoyed it immensely.
Chris, thank you so much, my friend. Hope to see you soon.
Thanks for joining us today on Ami Sites. Since 2010, multifunding has helped businesses achieve their biggest growth goals through creative and personalized funding solutions, working with a network of the nation's top lenders. Visit us at multifunding.com, where you can meet our advisory team and learn more about how we help entrepreneurs fund their future.